I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/achieve today.
You're listening to Text Message, the UK-focused technology podcast with me, Nate Langson.
And me, Ian Morris.
And firstly, thank you to everyone who's helped us hit the 150 review mark in the UK iTunes store, almost all of which are five-star. I think 145 of those 150 are five-star reviews. That is a wonderful number to wake up and see. So thank you to everybody there. I can see the most recent person was Speedy Coyote 1, followed by Daniel Price, both of whom have left reviews in the last week. So you've pushed us over the edge for this podcast. So thank you ever so much to both of you for doing that. We've also had some emails coming into podcast@natelangson.com. We're going to get to throughout the show. Just to begin with, before we get into news, and we're going to start with Tesco Bank's hack, which has a lot to say about that. I wanted to mention a couple of things from last week's show. We talked about Virgin Mobile zero rating WhatsApp messages and Facebook Messenger. And one of the things that we talked about last week was how it isn't zero rating video calling, which is sort of the one thing that you'd really benefit from being zero rated. And I contacted Virgin Mobile to try and figure out why they're not zero rating, and got a very honest answer back. This is a quote I got back from their spokesperson. WhatsApp and Facebook Messenger, text messages, images, and video messages are all encrypted and remain so, because I asked about encryption. We zero rate the destination address at Facebook to ensure these don't get charged. Video calling is also encrypted, but it's peer-to-peer, so it's not possible to zero rate a destination address, as it will be dynamic.
That's a really good answer. Like, I've had some PR answers in my time, and that is probably the best one, really.
Yeah, absolutely.
It just explains exactly what they're doing and why, and it takes away any ability for anyone to be, like, conspiratorial about it. It's just it's quite clear.
Yeah, absolutely. And if anybody did miss last week's episode and wants to know what all that's about, it is in the RSS feed, of course. Do go and check that out. Also had a few emails about the zero rating, as we kind of predicted we probably would. Toby says that he's glad to hear Virgin opted to roll over unused data to the next month. He says this is encouraging because this was the pattern that applied to voice and text before all the suppliers started offering unlimited calls and texts. Hopefully this is the first nail in the coffin of the ridiculous current practice of trying to meter data like it's water. In the meantime, at least the budget users who do run out of data some months get a bit of a buffer. And he thanks for the good stuff on the podcast. Also had a note come in from Sim, who says, I think it's a slippery slope. While it appears consumer friendly, as soon as companies start playing favorites and zero rating data from selected apps, they're encouraging the use of them at the expense of competition. Treating all data equally is one of the key tenets of the internet as we know it and needs to be protected. Why? Sim asks. Well, giving ISPs the license to have a price differentiation on data means they could also do the reverse and charge apps to have their data trafficked equally. Brackets, he notes here, see a case of Verizon throttling Netflix in the US during peak hours. Well, thanks to everybody for writing in. podcast@natelangson.com. That is where you can send your email, or you can send on the form if you just go to techpodcast.uk or natelangson.com/podcast or textmessage.co.uk. There are just so many options, but we welcome them all. Let's get into the news. And we've got a few items to get to today that happened over the last 7 days. And the first, Tesco Bank. And I've subtitled this topic, Unexpected Hack in the Banking Area.
I was blown away by that subhead. I mean, I just think it's inspired. What can I say?
Thank you, mate. Well, that is what you can say.
I said this to you when you proposed it, didn't I? I was like, that's amazing.
Thank you. Well, this is the news that Tesco suspended some parts of its online banking system earlier this week after it detected attempts to steal cash from customer accounts, specifically people with current accounts or checking accounts to you guys in the States, which they blocked from making online payments using their debit cards on Sunday as a security measure. Obviously, the bank has apologized, and the quote is, we'd like to apologize for the worry and inconvenience this issue caused, according to the bank's boss. And the BBC News story that I saw first said that Tesco had spotted suspicious transactions on about 40,000 accounts over the weekend, with money initially reported to have been taken from about half of those accounts, about 20,000. Tesco has about 7 million customers in the UK, so it's a challenger bank, but it's on the smaller side of that. But still, 20,000 estimated customers being affected out of 7 million isn't a huge amount. But later in the week, Tesco said it had refunded £2.5 million to about 9,000 customers who'd had money taken in the attack, and that they pointed out personal data wasn't compromised. It was just money being taken from the account. So 9,000 actually affected customers out of initially suspected 40,000 out of a total of 7 million potential customers affected. So it's small scale on the one hand, but one cybersecurity expert that I saw quoted in the news did say that this was an unprecedented breach. And the quote here from a guy called Professor Alan Woodward at Europol, he was a security consultant who had worked at Europol, said, "I've not heard of an attack of this nature and scale on a UK bank where it appears the bank's central system is the target." Ian, have you heard of such a hack?
No, I haven't, and it's extremely worrying, isn't it? Because for whatever else we might say about our banks, they're usually, and it's in their interest to be so, they're usually pretty secure. And this, I was just chatting with this with some family, and I would say that, you know, because people are very aware that they have a lot of security to log into their online banking, they kind of feel secure, and that's rightly so, because actually those security steps are pretty good on the whole. But this obviously went behind that and became something where, you know, these hackers were able to get into the bank systems, which is extremely alarming, because if you can do that, then, well, you can do pretty much anything, can't you? And I mean, I suspect that because there was a relatively large volume of attempted transactions, they were presumably trying to make it look honest and not steal too much money from too many people. I don't mean honest, I mean, you know, like make it look like a legitimate transaction and not to be taking things, you know, too much from any one account. But obviously, I heard on the radio, the first thing I heard about this was people who didn't have enough, you know, very much money in the first place were being left without any money, and Tesco's wasn't refunding it quickly enough at the time. You know, these people were, I guess, low income families who didn't have no excess in their bank account, and it was having a big impact on those people. So really, kind of a big problem and scary.
That's one of the things that I saw mentioned as well, is that normally you see these happen to single or very few accounts with a lot of money. But you're right, these were affecting people. One person in particular I saw mentioned, he had £600 in his bank and he was left with about £20. But he had to save that £600, I think, for coal, for his heating system somewhere. He says, you know, this is just a very real effect on me. Like £600 to a hacker might not be that much money, but to me it's the ability to have a heated home and and feed my family. Yeah. And you've left me with £20.
Best thing to do in this situation would be for Tesco to say to people, well, look, we'll give you an automatic overdraft of the amount that was missing or something like that, so that it really people can just carry on living their lives until Tesco's can return the money and stuff like that. But
I think one of the things I remember seeing is that this was considered quite generally quite good on Tesco's part. They came out very quickly to announce that this had happened and to put a reason for the hack in the public's eye. And they also by Tuesday had refunded money to anyone who had their accounts compromised, yes, which is something they have to do. It's one of the things that being a licensed bank entitles you to have to do, is to refund, unless it's the user's fault or stupidity or something. But they have done that very, very quickly, it seems. Let's talk just briefly about some of the ways that this can happen. Some people have talked about this potentially having been the result of people attaching skimming devices. So this is kind of card readers, cloning devices, or even cameras, specifically at Tesco's own cash machines, which they do have around the country. This is the kind of thing where sometimes it can be a tiny little camera. It's why you should always check when you're putting your card into a machine that there's nothing suspicious above or below the device. I often find that if the device, the little hole that you put the card into, if it's a bit wobbly, that's always a warning sign. And because the cards are always faced up, I always put one of my fingers over the numerical strip when I slide the card in. So if a camera is above it, it can't read the code and obviously underneath where the security number is as well, you want to put your hand under there too. So that's one way that somebody has been theorizing that this can happen. The other thing is that it could have been an inside job, which I know is something you've thought about, Ian. It could be somebody who'd worked at Tesco Bank and had access to the database, maliciously or otherwise. Something may have slipped out.
I think that seems like an almost logical conclusion that to exploit something like this so specifically, it would have to be someone who was either able to get the information themselves or was fed the information by somebody on the inside.
And the other option is potentially that people are using the same password for their banking as other sites, which is, I thought, becoming more and more common knowledge that that's a terrible thing to do. But it is something we've seen happen time and time again. So again, just a little nod there. Change your passwords, people. Now, Tesco had declined to elaborate exactly on what had happened or actually how much total cash went missing, although perhaps by refunding $2.5 million, there is at least a hint that maybe $2.5 million went missing. And they're working with the National Crime Agency to investigate. Well, one comment that I got directly is from a gentleman called John Madeline. He's CEO of a company called Reliance ACSN, which is a British IT security firm. And he'd said the Tesco bank hack showcases the increased sophistication we are seeing in attacks from cybercriminals. First, it happened over a weekend, which is cunning. The best time to attack is when many key staff are away. Second, continues John, unlike phishing attacks, which are often an ongoing series of one-to-one events, this attack appears to have used some automation in targeting core systems. This is smart, as customers can be compromised far faster. Tesco is lacking in so many areas. There appears to be no good protection of core systems, no effective tools that pick up on compromises in real time, and no 24/7 security team coverage. Yet again, this shows the cybersecurity industry's lack of conviction. It has fundamentally failed to educate organizations on how to manage their security holistically. Despite private UK companies spending £2.24 billion on cybersecurity last year, across 75 separate cyber defense systems on average, two-thirds of big UK companies have been hit by a cyber attack in that time period. Pretty hardcore comment on the issue, but it does go to show that, you know, if you're a bank, you possibly need to think about whatever you're doing isn't enough.
No, it's never going to be, is it? I mean, I'd sort of agree with the first part of this, what that guy, what John Madeline says there. But at the same time, you know, you never will be able to completely protect anything from hackers. It's always going to happen at some point, isn't it? It's just, this seemed like a really unusual attack. But even so, I think it's somewhat unfair of an analyst to say that, you know, that banking isn't working hard to sort of stop the problem, because, you know, £2.24 billion is quite a lot of money to spend on security, isn't it?
Well, let us know what you think. And obviously, if you are an affected customer, or if you had any contact from Tesco, whether or not you are actually affected, we'd love to hear it and get some first-hand accounts of how this transpired, or not transpired, how this evolved over the week. We'd love to hear that. podcast@nateslangson.com. And of course, we'll treat it in confidence if you wish. Let's head up to Scotland, and specifically into the Scottish island of Arran. Spare wireless spectrum over on that island, left over from the digital TV switchover a few years ago, is going to be used to improve broadband access on the Scottish island of Arran. It's going to be a rollout which, according to the story I read on Wired, is the first of its kind in Europe. I certainly hadn't heard of one quite like this before. And it's going to be used to basically provide much faster access to about 5,000 residents of this island, quite a small island. And ideally, it's hoped that the use of this TV white space could actually help begin to bridge that broadband divide between urban and rural areas that we've talked about so much on the show, particularly over the last couple of weeks in terms of 4G coverage. Now, this technology is being rolled out through a partnership between the internet firm Nominet and a broadband campaign group called Broadway Partners. And it's kind of it's seen as something of a milestone moment, at least in terms of internet access, because islands suffer far worse for slow broadband speeds, even compared to some rural mainland areas. it does look like it's improving. Apparently in January, about 2,000 homes and businesses in Arran and a neighbouring island in Cumbrae were hooked up to high-speed fibre broadband. That was part of a £146 million investment programme from the Scottish Government to improve internet access. But it points again to the answer to a lot of these rural broadband issues lying in wireless. The Scottish Government paid, you know, over £100 million to solve the problem with fibre for 2,000 homes and businesses. But this wireless solution is going to affect more than twice, potentially, the number of residents, 5,000. Although, to be fair, the 2,000 was homes, 5,000 residents. Could maybe average out to be about the same, but still, pretty interesting development in terms of getting islands connectivity, right, Ian?
Yeah, I mean, I really like these ideas. I mean, that spectrum is unused, so it makes sense to sort of redeploy it as broadband speed assistance. You know, it's one of those things that I kind of feel like they should do more of that, especially in rural areas, because you can't physically put down as much cable as you probably would want to. Well, I mean, you could, but it becomes very expensive, and wireless offers a really low cost alternative that gives people a fast access to the internet. So I'm all for it, obviously. Why would I be anything but? I love broadband, and I think everyone should get access to it.
Well, I mean, there was a story I remember from a little while ago that talked about how there was some little island in the Pacific that, because of the nature of where it was and the fact that it had like one cable off the undersea backbone that fed it, it had speeds that eclipsed pretty much anything else that anybody anywhere else in the US got. I can't remember the name of the island. I'm sure somebody will Google it and answer it for us.
And those are good, great ideas, aren't they? Because basically, if you're running an undersea cable, it makes sense to bring it up if there's an island, because you can then do your boosting and all that kind of stuff without having to, you know, go underwater, which is obviously really difficult. So if you happen to be in an island in the sea and, you know, they run a cable past you, then you're going to be laughing, aren't you? I would love to live on an island.
I can just imagine it now. I can just see people walking down the street. Oh, speedy internet. I can just see that in my mind's eye, Ian.
Well, given world events, if you could find me an island with high-speed internet, I'd be very happy to go and live there.
Well, I'm pretty sure I literally just did.
Yes.
Tell you what, when I published the podcast, listen back about 2 minutes ago, I mentioned this island in the Pacific.
Yes, I know, but you didn't tell me what the name of the island was. What am I supposed to just sort of swim around and try and find this nebulous island that might have fast broadband?
Yes.
Get me a name, then I'll move there.
Okay. I've been doing some real-time Googling to answer this facetiousness that I'm subject to. Tonga.
Tonga. Good old Tonga.
Tonga. And they've got very fast internet.
I'm just having a look on the map just to see exactly how far away from absolutely everything it is.
Well, it's 2,000 miles east of Australia and 500 miles southeast of Fiji, which I think is fairly well known to be incredibly remote. It's got over 100,000 citizens.
It's south. I mean,
this collective of islands, that is.
Yeah, I mean, it looks great. I mean, do you think I could get it on one of those smaller islands? Because I'm just thinking, really, I've lost complete faith in absolutely everyone. So what I'm looking for, really, is a tiny, tiny little island with very, very fast internet access.
Well, this is one of them. But let's stay on the topic of internet access in a slightly potentially more accessible part of the world. The mainland Britain, specifically, because BT Openreach next year is going to offer up to 1 gigabit per second fibre broadband. Or to be more specific, BT Openreach is going to make it available for people to resell. Now, at the moment, those resales are as high as 330 megabits per second. I don't know of many people who are actually reselling the 330 megabit per second fibre package that BT offers. But next year, it's going to be up to 1 gigabit per second. And they're also going to have another speed of 500 megabits per second. And the crucial little sub-headline in all this is that the 1 gigabit per second connection will offer an upload speed, allegedly, of 220 megabits per second, which is roughly the same download speed as some of the fastest Virgin Media connections.
Beautiful.
Yeah, and on the 500 meg download option, there'll be 165 megabit per second upload speed. So you're going to upload on that at about 20 megabytes per second. So incredibly fast. And if you're somebody who's uploading or backing up a lot of 4K video that you're shooting on your iPhones and your Android devices that are coming out now, you know, these are taking up hundreds of megabytes per video if you're recording for even a few minutes. So these kind of upload speeds are going to become extremely compelling. And the really frustrating thing that I see is that despite having a 200 megabit fiber to the premises connection, I still get faster upload speeds on my 4G mobile.
You know, you can, with Virgin, you can pay and have double the upload. You can
get double 20.
Terrible.
Yeah, I get 16 at the moment. Is it 12 or 16?
12.
12 megabits up. I mean, double is pointless. You know, give me 100 megabits.
Well, I wouldn't say it's pointless. It's not as great as it should be. But Virgin has consistently been disappointing with upload speeds. It's extremely frustrating.
And
if you ever saturate it as well, you really know about it because it destroys everything.
Well, this option is going to be available for resale from the 6th of December, apparently.
Well, I would switch. If that's a possibility for them to come to me, then I'd be thrilled.
Yeah. So Sky, TalkTalk, BT, obviously itself, BT Retail, may be able to sell you that. Obviously, it'll probably depend on exactly whereabouts in the country you're based. But still, 1 gigabit fibre to the premises.
Quite expensive, though, isn't it? I mean, I as much as I say I would like it, can I really? I mean, it's going to be 100-odd quid, isn't it, by the time I finish selling it to you?
Well, the only cost I've got is that it's going to be the cost to the retailer is £80
yeah,
pounds
exactly.
Per month.
So it's going to be over 100 quid, isn't it, by the time the retailer's slapped on their profit.
True, but it's only a matter of time before that comes down. And even still, if a 1 gigabit is £80 to retailers, let's just halve everything. 500 megabits yeah. per second might be 40 to retailers. Well, that might come to 60 to us.
Yeah.
If you rely on that sort of speed, £60 a month,
I do.
It's not a lot of money if that's particularly for you, you know, running your own business from a home office.
Yeah.
That's compelling. Well, if you see any of these figures as being attractive to you, maybe an early Christmas present to yourself, let us know what you think, podcast@natelengson.com. And if you're listening on the island of Arran, and I have to say, I haven't noticed any of you in our statistics coming from that island, but let us know.
Well,
and let
us know. Until now, they didn't have fast enough broadband, but now they'll be all over it.
Well, if you are, podcast@natelengson.com, let us know. Well, let's just dip my hands into my sack here, my mail sack, my mail bag sack, the email, the inbox.
Satchel, mate, satchel.
That's what I'm going for. We've got another one here, come from Rob, who's after some advice, Ian. He says, hi there, as a tech guy and anglophile, I appreciate your efforts. Well, we appreciate your listening. A couple of things from yesterday's podcast, although actually we're only going to read one of them because we haven't got time to talk about both. A, mobile. I'll be visiting with my kids in a few weeks, and I'm wondering who has the best plan for pay-as-you-go SIMs for our phones, data for me, and calling and messaging for them. Well, we've had a little look, and we have a bit of advice for you. And we are going to recommend that for data, if you want a more budget option, then 3 is pretty good for you. I imagine you're visiting one of the cities, and that's the reason we're recommending 3, because you get a bit more for your money, and in the city, they tend to have better coverage. If you are just looking for voice and data, then possibly even consider Tesco Mobile, which is on the back of, it's O2, isn't it, Tesco users? Was it EE?
I think it's O2, isn't it?
Either way, it's one of the big networks it's on the back of, but it's a more budget plan. So you get decent calls and minutes for your money. And if you just want really fast data, then go for EE, who tend to be more expensive and you get less for your money, but they are bloody quick. Any of those options are not going to cost you more than about £10 for a 30-day option. And I would advise, no matter what you go for, you probably don't need to spend more than £15 to £20 for the whole month.
It's good, isn't it, when you come here? Because, I mean, you know, for all the many, many flaws of this country, it's not like that when you go to America. If you want to just buy a SIM card, it's just really difficult. So,
well, that actually reminds me of something we should point out, is that depending on what phone you're using, if you've got an unlocked phone from AT&T or, forget which the other one is.
Verizon?
Verizon.
Yeah, T-Mobile.
Verizon, T-Mobile, thank you. Yeah, if you're on AT&T or T-Mobile, they use GSM, which means you can, as long as your phone is unlocked and not tied to those networks, you should be able to put any other GSM SIM, which will work for any of these that I've just discussed. If you're on Verizon or Sprint, I don't think it's quite so easy, so you might want to do some Googling about what the best practice is there, because they don't use the same GSM standard that is over here. So I'm not 100% sure how you would go around doing that. But your network will advise the best. And in terms of picking a network to use, hopefully we've given you some decent advice there. Ian and I are available for all of your tech questions, of course. podcast@natelangson.com. If you'd like us to answer something concisely in 3 minutes, drop us a line there. We're always happy to put on the Agony Ant costumes, aren't we, Ian?
Well, we certainly are.
Always have, in fact. Let's get on with a bit more news. A couple of things I wanted to touch on. First, WH Smith's, the ever-expanding brick and mortar seller of pretty much anything they can cram into the window.
I'm not sure I would describe them as ever-expanding, but yeah.
Have you looked at a WH Smith recently?
They're a lot more down-market than they used to be.
It's just every inch has something in it.
Yeah.
You walk in and it's like a wall of stuff. I mean, you go to a till and sometimes even the tills are just covered in chocolate bars and sweets. And you know, when you put whatever it is you're buying, you're putting them on top of chocolate. It's like, how much crap can we cram into this space? But it is what it is.
It is.
It's going to add to that expanding collection of stuff by selling games in some stores. Game, the troubled retailer of video games over the last few years, is going to start opening up stands, from what I've been able to gather, kind of like a shop within a shop sort of area for WH Smith's in a few places. Not sure which. It's an ongoing trial across stores that they've been doing this year. But I think that's quite a nice idea, isn't it? Two high street retailers teaming up to make games more accessible in an industry that's rapidly moving online.
Yeah, I mean, well, this is the thing. I mean, the problem with gaming retail is the prices are really, how do I put it? Eclectic is probably not the right word, but so I'll give you a really good example, right? I fancy buying, there's been a few good games recently, and I thought, oh yeah, I'd like to have a game. But it turns out that it's often more expensive to buy a digital code than it is to buy a disc, have it posted to you, and then put that disc in your drive and install the game, which actually makes no sense at all, does it? So I feel like there is a potential for retail to be a lot smarter and on the high street and still make money without, you know, because the whole move to online is a lot about stock availability movement. It's about reducing costs, isn't it? But if you go into a WH Smith and they just have a rack of cards and the cards have the game names printed on and the game names, you know, and you have a serial number, that's a lot easier and there's very little shipping and, you know, it could be a huge thing. I don't think that for all of the doomsayers, you know, high street retail could be good because, you know, sometimes I think, oh yeah, I'd really like a game and I just happen to be in town and I could go and buy one, but I don't do it because the prices are wrong.
I've noticed on the consoles, we fired up the PS4 the other day to...
Oh,
I can't remember what we were playing.
The PlayStation Store is my absolute favourite example of crap pricing.
It's just ridiculous.
It's unbelievable,
I mean, I think Skyrim Special Edition was like £50. I mean, even undiscounted on Amazon, it was £32 for Skyrim Special Edition. And on Steam, I forget what the exact price on Steam because I had already had the DLC bundle, so I didn't actually have to buy it. But Steam's pricing is famously flexible. But it just made me wonder, like, what is the possible benefit other than immediacy to spending £20 more for a game through the console than ordering it from Amazon or going to a shop? As you say, eclectic is actually quite a good word. Unpredictable might be another.
This is the thing.
Scam might be a third.
Well, and it's certain kinds of games are really, really suffer from this.
AAA stuff, really.
Yeah, but I mean, and also, you know, is £50 really a fair price for a game? Okay, I mean, maybe, because they spend a lot of time and effort on it. But would they not sell more copies at £40? You know, I've just, I bought this recently, I bought Titanfall 2, I was going to buy Gears of War, but because I bought a GPU, I did eventually get a free code for it. So that was good. And then there was, what's it called? A Forza Horizon 3. You know, that's over 100 quid's worth of games right there, isn't it? And, it feels like they would probably sell more copies of games if they were a bit more sensibly priced, especially when it is, when it doesn't cost them anything to make the actual thing or ship it anyway. All I want is to go on the Microsoft website, buy a Forza Horizon 3, and it could be 40 quid. And that would probably be the sweet spot for me.
I mean, you're arguing over the laws of economics, which is not confined to games. You know, I think it's an age-old argument, isn't it?
That it is.
If you sell at a lower cost, will you sell more and therefore make more overall? I mean, that's how sales work, isn't it?
Yeah, but the thing is as well, I'll give you a really good example of this, okay? So Titanfall 2 is a really great game, okay? If you haven't played it, you absolutely should play it because the single-player campaign reminds me, not at all in the storyline, but the way it plays reminds me enormously of Half-Life 2. So it's just one of those really nicely done sort of narrative things. And yeah, it's very corridory, so you're being pushed along a story, but it's actually really enjoyable to play. And I haven't felt like that about a single player campaign for a long time. And maybe probably Half-Life 2 wasn't the last time, but it definitely reminded me. But that game isn't selling because it is also sandwiched between Call of what's it called and, you know, the other thing, Battlefield. So perhaps drop the price. Perhaps go, yeah, it's not selling. Let's get it out for 35 or something. And it would shift huge. And, you know, they'd still make money on it. In fact, they'd make a lot more money on it. It's my belief. But
I would play Titanfall 2, but it's only on the Windows crap store thing, not on Steam.
No, Titanfall you can get on Origin.
It's not on Steam, though.
No, it's not on Steam.
And that's the only place I want to give any of my money
to.
Well,
I know, I understand, but even so, sometimes you just have to.
Interesting. I think Titanfall 2 actually runs on the Source engine, which is same engine that powers Half-Life. So I wonder if that's a reason why it runs
well, maybe,
so
maybe it just
readily.
Because it feels the same. Like it's kind of like one of those things where it has the graphical something or other that's just made me think of it. I can't speak highly enough of it. I mean, it isn't a long campaign. I haven't finished it yet, but I honestly do feel like it's really entertaining.
Well, we've drifted just about far enough off course for me to need to point it out in case any listeners thought that we haven't noticed that this has delved into a pub-like conversation around our favourite recent video games. You can continue this conversation with us if you wish on @textmessagepod, which is where we live on Twitter. I've noticed an increase in people following us there, so thank you very much. We are wrapping up the show at this point, and Ian is at IanMorris78. I'm at Nate Langson on Twitter, and you can talk to us about games. Thank you to everyone who's been leaving us reviews. Please, please, please keep them coming. It's helped us get recognised as hot in the current iTunes Tech Chart homepage. So thank you very much for that. And unless there's anything else, we will see you in 1 week.
My business used to be weighed down by the complexities of in-person payments. Then, Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe came along and changed everything. With Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe, I streamlined my payment process effortlessly. Now I can accept in-person, contactless payments right from my iPhone. No extra hardware required. What's truly remarkable is how I can cater to all of my customers' payment preferences, whether they're using cards, Apple Pay, or other digital wallets, Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe ensure a smooth checkout experience every time. And it's not just me. Stripe helps businesses of all sizes, from local markets to global retailers, scale quickly and stay agile. To learn how Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe can help grow your revenue and reach, visit stripe.com/tapiphone.